This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 43. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Ruzbeh Batcha, CEO and founder of City Falcon. City Falcon's mission is to democratize access to financial news, thereby creating a level playing field for all investors, whether retail or institutional. They provide comprehensive, real-time and relevant financial news, which is free for consumers and a modest fee for business. We'll turn on to them in more detail later in the show. Ruzbeh has won a clutch of awards, for example, from Twitter, UBS, Standard Bank, and the Ministry of Ontario in the entrepreneurial arena. Ruzbeh founded this company in an archetypal way in his bedroom, and it has now grown to over a dozen staff. Over the period, he has blogged in an impressively honest way about the journey and what it's really like being a young fintech. Those of you who listened to the previous show, LFP 042, the 2016 New Year special, will have heard me take a deep dive into media distortions. In essence, for a whole bunch of reasons, there is what one might call a war on truth. This applies whether it's the mainstream media on war, the euro, or health, all the way down to the well-known phenomenon that people post only about the sunny side of their coin of life on Facebook. And this is as true in fintech as any sector. In fact, fintech is probably more hyped than anything I can think of at the moment. So, as with LFP 039, when Alexander Gaillard was on the show talking about the life of a European fintech startup, we're here to talk about real primary journalism, as Julian Assange calls it, interviewing a coal miner who has been at the coalface long enough and is honest enough to share what it's really like. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Ruzbeh. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. And I still remember 2 years back where we sat down discussing our business ideas, and I guess we can say we've achieved a reasonable amount in the last 2 years.
Yes, that's true. I was remembering it myself as well. It was near London Bridge and we had coffee, and it was literally just at the time I was looking at launching a podcast in this sector. And so naive was I about the tech scene as such that I didn't even know Google Campus existed, where I hung out quite a lot, and I think also at Silicon Drinkabout, which I went to for about a year or so before I moved on from just looking at the startup scene. And it's very interesting that what goes around comes around. I've noticed myself that people doing startups and people doing larger companies, most of them don't really realize that actually being kind and helpful to people goes a long way. It never goes very far in terms of getting help from them tomorrow, but you never know what happens later in the scene. And as you say, we've grown along the way. And we'll come on to how much you've grown soon. So one of the things we were talking about at the time was you've got a whole bunch of backgrounds in big companies like Microsoft, Skype, Nokia, and all that kind of thing. But you're originally from Mumbai, from Mumbai in India, which used to be called Bombay when it was part of the empire.
Yes. And just going back to my journey and thinking about why I'm doing things that I'm doing is going back to what my hero, who is my dad, did when, you know, times were tough in India. So, you know, not very well educated, but a lot of responsibility with the family. And what he did was he never kept his money idle. He would always invest in money, be it in mutual funds or be it in IPOs or whatever little he can understand. But what that meant was that with inflation skyrocketing in India, at least our returns kept pace. And today, you know, he could help me and my sister provide the quality of education that I'm really thankful about.
Yes, it's an interesting concept, really, in that many people seem to treat money passively. They just lock it up, or actively in terms of spending it. But going back to the parable of the talents, there's something else you can do with it, which you can use it in a creative way to create things. And as we'll come on to later, when you're creating things, you can certainly burn through money fairly rapidly. And talking about this word, which is very unpolitically correct, immigration, it's a very hot word in Europe as a whole at the moment. One of the things I'd like to sort of focus in on, which is that the dialogue in the media, picking on the media again, is very simplistic. So roughly speaking, the left wing says immigration is a good thing, and the right wing says immigration is a bad thing. Both of them avoid two obvious points, which is that firstly, Britain is an island, and if we let the entire rest of the world in, which is 7 billion, the island will sink beneath the waves. And the second is that I've rarely seen, although occasionally in tech circles in this part of London, which is near the Old Street, Shoreditch, the more techie area, that it really depends what you mean by immigration. There's a whole range of people. You could have some Tuareg coming to London with his camels. That's one type of immigrant. Or we could have somebody like you with a whole bunch of tech experience and who has created over a dozen jobs. So as an immigrant, to say, it's kind of almost a rude word, how do you see the immigration process from the outside?
For me, I believe that, you know, rights of a human should not depend on where you were born, and it should be open to anyone who wants to pursue their dreams. And one of the things I struggle with is this perception that, and I'm very honest about, is that Britain's doing a favor by getting all these immigrants into the country. It's both ways, right? If we want to grow as a country, we need a lot of smart people. And as a lot of businesses would tell you, we don't have enough talent. We don't have enough engineers. We don't have enough, you know, design people, you know, developers. And this is what keeps us behind. This also results in cost of labor going significantly high, which means that, for example, as a fintech company, I'm just not able to compete against the big banks because I can't afford to pay that much.
Yes, no, I agree. And I mean, one of the problems, of course, in the UK is the property, and property is incredibly expensive in London, which is something outside the equation here. But as you say, there is a talent shortage. And if the UK economy is to grow, somehow that needs to be addressed. And I agree entirely that the UK should improve its education process and should make more tech people itself. However, I also heard that argument 40 years ago, and I'm still waiting to see a massive improvement. And at this rate, I'll be waiting in 40 years' time. So starting with your personal journey then, you say you come from India and you work for these large companies. So how come you're ending up working for a small company now, or your own company?
So, I mean, I've been working for a long time, but what's interesting is that from my perspective, when I was having my day job, you know, and I've been doing this for like 15 years, I would still get interested in the stock markets. It was something that was my passion. What is also interesting is one of my first jobs when I was doing my ACA, I had an offer to work with a big bank in a trading unit. At the same time, I had an offer from KPMG. And I went to the bank and I just looked at how the traders were trading and I said, I just can't do that, and ended up going to KPMG. But yeah, investing is my passion. A day when a market is shut, I sometimes get really bored during the day. There isn't much happening in my life. So I've done all of that. So I've worked with a lot of companies, working with KPMG, then moved on to Nokia Music. I've worked with Skype, and then we got bought out by Microsoft. I think the turning point in my life was working at Skype, where I joined the mobile team. We saw the hockey stick growth. But at the same time, I also realized the reasons why Skype today is not your WhatsApp for consumers or Slack for companies. Because Skype had all the features. What it lacked were other things, which, you know, I don't want to get in at this point.
Yeah. Skype today annoys me. Every time I try and use the thing, I don't know if it's because I've got a Vista computer, which I need to upgrade, but every time I try and use the bloody thing, it sort of spends about a week downloading some new software. And normally as I've turned it 1 minute before I need the call, it's really sort of gone downhill, I think. But it's quite often the case with software that it ends up being bloatware.
I think, and again, I don't want to talk a lot of things that I shouldn't be on this show, but I think a lot of times what happens is as companies mature and as founders move out, things move on from solving a problem, running a company that's about user experience and innovation, to moving on to profitability and numbers and, you know, metrics. And just to say that, you know, Skype was a private equity owned company for a long time before it was acquired by Microsoft.
Yes, everything ends up being run by accountants. And going back to 2 years ago when we met for the first time, in 2014, there really was startup mania in London as a whole, in fintech and in other tech sectors, and it was something that's sort of very exciting. I don't think that actually the reality at the moment is that one's seeing many new startups at all. They are still there, but nowhere near like a couple of years ago. And certainly for myself, I find it much more interesting having a world where there's lots of indie coffee shops, shall we say, than the big three chains, which don't produce such good produce. And the same applies in tech and in fintech. It's much more interesting when there's a whole bunch of stuff going on rather than it's settled down. So 2 years on, you were a startup. You've now been going for some time. What are the things that you've found have been the main differences in reality from what you might perceive by the media, whether it's the mainstream media or indie or social media or anything like that? What's it actually like at the coalface compared to what you were led to believe before you went down to that particular coalface?
That's a very good question. Before I started off on my own, the perception for me was that there's a lot of money out there, be it from angel investors because of SEIS and EIS, a lot of venture money flowing into Europe, a lot of government grants coming through to startups. But having done this for 2 years, the reality is very different. Yes, there is a lot of funding, but it's for particular categories of people. Europe still is a very risk-averse place. Investors need a reason to invest in you and your company. So I would say, and I talked about this, there are three categories where you will get funding very easily. If you are a rock star product manager, or if you are a serial entrepreneur, yes, VCs will throw money at you. Second, if you've worked in the city for a long time and you can raise millions by making a few calls, yes, you will be able to start your business. And the third is anything which is popular. And you know, this thing that you learn in your MBA, which is fast second. So a lot of VCs told me that they will actually not give you money if you're innovative. But if someone has already done that before and they've shown that they're successful, they'll give you money. So today, if you're looking at blockchain, Bitcoin, you know, there's a time where P2P was so popular. I mean, if you look at back in the day, social media was really popular. And so if you are in those three categories, you'll raise a lot of money and without problem. And that's what media picks up. But the reality is, if you go to level 39 and meet the startups who are sitting in the pantry area, you'll realize how difficult it is to raise money.
Yes, the problem about what is the size of money, we've touched on a number of times. Ana Herrera from the Financial News was on before Christmas talking about how much money the big companies were putting into fintech. I read a report this morning which says that $15 to $20 billion, or was it $20 to $25 billion, are going to put into fintech. Frankly, I think that's a complete load of bollocks. And the people who are saying that are really just talking about something completely different, which is what's the IT spend in finance, which has some overlap, but it's very, very minimal overlap. And in terms of both startups, but also scale-ups, the conversations I've had over the last 2 years have all been along the lines that you say. It doesn't matter whether they're larger companies than you or smaller companies than you. Everyone has said that the worst part of it is the nightmare of raising funds. You can spend 3 to 6 months. You talk to a bunch of folks, most who don't actually sort of understand what you're doing, and all of whom have the rules of thumb you just mentioned. And if you're lucky, you get through that, and you've wasted 6 months of development time just actually getting the cash. And also that if you add up the sums of money, as you say, you used to be based at level 39, if you add up the sums of money that people raise there, it comes to nothing like these headline figures you see in media. It's utter, utter distortions.
Absolutely. And I think another way of looking at it is, if you break down into what is seed funding to what is, you know, Series A and upwards, I have probably spoken to more than 50 investors, from angel investors to VCs to, you know, these corporate venture teams sitting at the big banks trying to invest money in fintech. And everyone has one thing to say: we will invest. We'll invest at Series A when you have users and when you have traction. I've had a case where one VC told me, we'll give you £1 million when you have revenue of £500,000. The issue for most of us UK startups is, how do we get to Series A? Because at seed funding, what investors demand is to keep the valuation low, to raise very little amount of money, which means that we cannot hire the talent that we need to be a successful company.
Yes, there's a real bootstrap thing going on here. And again, speaking to companies in the scale-up stage, the ones that I know very well will say to me, well, actually, one thing that really makes a difference in the scale-up is actually, you know, we had a good bunch of guys at the beginning, but now we have a really good bunch of guys because actually we can afford the really good bunch of guys, you know. So it's very hard to bootstrap. And I think, again, one of the things that you put your finger on very well, which is that if you do come from a FS background and you've been around a while, or from some investment banking background, you've got a whole bunch of mates that are prepared to sort of throw 10% of their bonus at you and don't really sort of care very much. And that will help get over the first thing. So we hear all this stuff about the funding gap and all that kind of thing. But I think in this world, in practice, it means, as you say, getting to the stage where you've got £500,000 of revenue. And, well, if you want to call them grown-ups or not, I don't know. But the more grown-up sort of VCs will then be prepared to put the money into you.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons, and watch out for my blog on this, is that the late-stage entrepreneurs, and this is for entrepreneurs in general, right? Most entrepreneurs don't understand finance as well. They are very passionate people solving problems, really good product people. So what they end up doing is, at a late stage where you have the bargaining power, they sign on to term sheets, which pretty much are, you know, give me the upside of common equity with downside protection of debt. So this will be a massive, you know, 5-page term sheet, which has somehow become a standard in the industry. And people think it's fair for us to sign these terms. So what this means is that late stage investors are taking lower risk. So there is no incentive for them to move early stage to increase the returns or protect the downside, because you can get away doing that at a late stage.
Yes, I think a lot of this is about the power relationship. I mentioned the previous podcast, Lemmy from Motorhead passed away over Christmas, and I was watching an interview with him in the early days of both Hawkwind, who I was a great fan of at the time, but also Motorhead, which is that when you're a new startup band, you play in the clubs and all that kind of thing, and you make next to no money, and you get lots of chicks, which is the more than fringe benefit, the sort of core benefit. And all you're desperate to do is get a record deal, and you've never signed a record deal in your life. And eventually, if you're really, really lucky, someone comes along with a record deal, and you're so pleased to sign it. And then you work several times harder than you worked in the first place, doing even more and more gigs. And then after a couple of years, you realise that although you're being chauffeured around in limos and getting even more chicks and drugs and alcohol, all that kind of stuff, actually you're making no money whatsoever. And it's only sort of 10 or 20 years into it that you realise what the industry is all about, which is basically just sort of screwing people at an early stage. And I mean, you know, and a related story was that Lemmy was a roadie for Jimi Hendrix in the late 60s. And I recall seeing a programme about Jimi Hendrix. And it was saying that at one point, his manager took him to some mansion in the middle of nowhere and got a gun to his head and said, "Do you want to walk out of this building alive?" You know, that's the realpolitik of the music business. So maybe out of that story, you can get something positive, which is that at least you're not in the music industry. So funding is much, much, much more of a challenge. And I'd say everything I've heard validates that your experience isn't an outlier, but it's a core experience, much, much, much more of a challenge. There is nowhere near like the numbers that you see going round. And I think that one of the challenges that you mentioned to me before was that government, who could actually help sort of fund some of this stuff, and I judged a government competition last year, which was giving out a number of fintech grants, they have the perception, because they read the media too, that there's masses of money out there. So actually, it's not a sort of, quotes, area of market failure or something that they need to promote. So they don't bother doing it either. So actually, there's quite a lot of money missing. Moving on to the second area, which no doubt you know much more about than when you started, is the process, which is that the reality that everybody finds, whether you're doing a podcast or a news information service or any other kind of startup, is that the reality of the time to market, the length of the sales process, cost of customer acquisition, and all the sort of boring MBA phrases like that, is much bigger than you thought in the first place.
Absolutely. And I think the lot of things that we've learned. So we talk about minimum viable product in technology. You know, put it out there, let's see how customers respond. The challenge for us in fintech is our customer, our target base is so impatient. You know, imagine me going to someone who is trading or investing, that unless the product is good enough for them to use, has all the features, they're not going to try it out. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, so going back actually, just to complete on the first point, in terms of the product, you have to spend much longer than in a typical technology product, which requires you to spend a lot of money.
Yes, and your product doesn't have money flowing through it, but if you're the kind of fintech that's got money flowing through it, it absolutely has to work 100.00% of the time, because if WhatsApp is down for 10 minutes and you can't sort of chat to your mate, or like Twitter was down the other day, we couldn't tweet to each other, so be it, life goes on. But if your financial services app, which processes money, is down and the money disappears, that's really, 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 really bad news.
Yeah, and I think that the issue that we face in the UK is, you know, people prefer service companies to product companies, because service companies, you can start making money in month two, which doesn't require a lot of development work. And so, you know, people are ready to put money into it. But as a product company, it's really challenging because investors keep chasing you. Where are your clients? Where is your money? But if you don't have enough money, you can't build a product that appeals to your clients. It's like selling a half-baked cake to, you know, your customers.
Yes, I suspect one of the other things as well, which is came back to these sort of phrases, which to me increasingly sound like sort of cliches, but there's this one called product market fit. And going back to, we were chatting in the autumn of 2014 at Level 39, and you were busy showing me, the stage was much sort of much earlier, you were busy showing me a new product that you'd knocked up over the weekend, another new product, all this kind of stuff. So there's a kind of proliferation, which is in a sense a part of a Darwinian mechanism for finding product market fit and putting stuff in front of people, and they say, oh my God, now I really want that one.
Absolutely. And, you know, from where we started off, you know, from where I started off in, I remember it was December 24th, 2013, when I started building this product, it has changed significantly. So one of the things we've done is we ask our customers, I go take them out for beer. So we've got feedback from more than 80 people telling us what works, what doesn't work. And we've kind of worked on that and built that within our product.
Yes. Yeah, so we'll come on a bit later to where you've ended up in terms of product and how it may be interesting to the listeners. There are various other sort of practicalities around London. I mean, you've said in your writings that London does actually, notwithstanding all the aforementioned, provide a massive opportunity. And, you know, there are issues like it's very hard getting talent that understands both fin and tech. What do you think of these other core concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I still believe that London's a great place for a fintech startup just because of the concentration of your clients in one small area of London, be it City, Canary Wharf, and all of that. So that provides a massive opportunities. I think the issue for me personally was that I believed it was much better than it actually is. So yes, London's a better place than most other places, but still behind Silicon Valley in terms of, you know, access to talent, in terms of the startup ecosystem and a lot of those things. One of the key challenges we faced is, you know, we've raised £200,000 in our seed round. That's what I could manage to raise through our friends. The kind of money that people expect in London, even if you throw, you know, stock options at them, is just ridiculous. Like, I can't afford to have people here. And this is a challenge. Also, what happens is, you know, when someone's building a camera app, most people understand, developers understand. But when you're building a finance app, you know, a fintech app, what you have to do is your specs need to be very clear. Those people who understand both are very rare and are usually picked up by the big banks.
Yes, it's interesting because I was just having a conversation earlier today with someone who should remain nameless, who had the opposite perception, which is actually, in the, as a bank, it's really quite hard because people want to do the sort of sexier stuff. So I think that's what you say is right. But I think also there's a part of the sort of the grass is always greener. And, you know, coming back to comparison, I mean, San Francisco, as far as I understand, rather than the Valley these days, coming back to comparison and picking up one of the points you said earlier about the funding, there's lots of propaganda about how democratizing this ability to start new companies is. And it is much easier to start a new company than it used to be. But if you scratch much below the surface, you find that actually it's a kind of elite. And certainly in America, they tend to be white, male, Anglo-Saxon background. And, you know, they're in the know and they have the contacts. And they are massively overrepresented. I mean, I don't like this unicorn phrase, but I did see some analysis of unicorns recently, and it was something like 2014% of them are white Anglo-Saxon males from, you know, three universities in the States or that kind of thing. So there's much less diversity than you would think. And I think the other point, which is always omitted when people talk about Silicon Valley and that, because it's not just outside the UK, whether it's in India or in Europe, or in the UK, but even on the East Coast. I mean, the East Coast in the States has done a lot of looking at the West Coast and going, oh, how come we can't do that in Washington or New York? And nobody's really replicated it. But the one thing which is omitted, I mean, last time around I was talking about sort of the war on truth and the near-imperialistic war pigs killing people all over the place, which distresses me more than somewhat. And I think the one thing that is always omitted in all descriptions of Silicon Valley, San Francisco, is that the US spends roughly more on weapons and military stuff than the rest of the world put together, and including all the sort of secret state and surveillance. You know, that's over $1 trillion per annum is going into tech in the broadest sense. So there's a massive trickle-down factor from that. You know, and it's not clear to me that, let's say, the US has stuck to its foreign policy position in the 30s, which was basically to leave the rest of the world to its own devices and to look after themselves, that actually you would have got that. And, you know, that continues to bias it. Just picking up another point you were making about London. Again, you read narratives which say, oh, there are loads of banks in London and there's lots of tech. Well, this is all true. But as I said, in terms of actually speaking to people, I know lots of people that have basically given up because they eventually found out the hard way that selling to a bank takes you about 2 years if you're lucky, even if you're selling it for free.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let me just touch on one point on Silicon Valley. And you will hear this argument that, hey, we are not Silicon Valley, so, you know, we do things differently. One of my biggest frustrations is, why are we not learning from the Valley? So I will tell you three things that why I think Valley is ahead of us.
Valley / San Francisco in this context.
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco, East Coast, New York as well. One is the funding, right? So you can raise, you know, a decent amount of money to actually build a proper business at reasonable valuation, so everyone is happy. Second is the startup ecosystem. You know, the second generation, third generation of entrepreneurs, you know, your investors helping you to hire people, helping you in the next fundraising round, you know, the events, everything happening is to actually scale and have impact. And the third thing, which I find really frustrating in the UK, is time wasters. There are too many time wasters in the UK.
Too many podcasters.
No, so I think when I say that is, so, you know, we do have a lot of events and a lot of conferences, right, where a lot of smart people are talking about how to run businesses. We have a lot of time when you meet people, be it, you know, investors, for example, even if they're not interested in investing your company, they end up taking a lot of your time. Send me this, send me that. You spend 3 days, 3 weeks. And the same thing is also with the sales process, for example. So if you're talking to potential customers, it's not faster. What I love about Silicon Valley, and I've interacted with a few people trying to raise funds, is even the emails are like three lines, no big sentences, bullet points sometimes. The conversations, when you speak to them, it's 10 minutes at times. They don't waste each other's time.
No, I agree with everything you say. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that San Francisco / Silicon Valley is the one place which is miles above everywhere else in terms of techs and startups. As you say, you're given a sensible sum of money there to see whether it works or not. I mean, a different way I'd heard of that explained to me in the past was that, which is that in the West Coast, if you've got a small fire, they'll throw petrol on to see whether you can get a big fire. Whereas in the UK, they'll throw cold water on it on the basis that if your fire can survive cold water, it Absolutely. Must be quite a good fire. So again, you know, this idea that sort of London is a brilliant place. Well, yes and no, like everything, you know, it's on the one hand and on the other hand. So moving on to more practical things, coming to City Falcon and, you know, having been through all these challenges around funding process, the pros and cons of London and all these dynamics, where are you today in terms of, you know, City Falcon's main product? I mean, what is it and who needs it, for example?
So City Falcon is anyone who is looking for fundamental financial news, from an average retail consumer to a broker that wants to serve consumers to businesses that need access to this information. And our focus is not only your, you know, your big traders, big investors, big banks, but also average people who want to generate higher than inflation returns.
So for example, if I'm sitting at home and I'm trading on my laptop, off the top of my head, if I want a Bloomberg or Reuters or any of the main providers terminal or information service or however it comes these days, it's going to cost me a few £1,000 a month.
Absolutely, absolutely. And our focus, and it again goes back to our vision and, you know, why we're doing this, is to help people have an impact. So I would want to keep our consumer offering free for as long as I can. And again, depending on how much funding, sustainability, and investor pressure.
And how many people have signed up for that at the moment?
So we have about 5,000 monthly uniques and close to about 2,000 registered users. What we are proud of is about 40% email open rate. And so a lot of people are interacting, engaging with what we do.
Which is a very impressive achievement in 2.5 years. Yes. Given that there's lots of other people trying to get consumers' attention, and we've got 10 fingers, we've got 10 toes, but we only have one attention each.
So for me, it was, and again, I started off with the belief that there's a lot of money. So the focus was to build a solid product. So we have had about 10 developers working nonstop for a year to build this product. And now we've come to a stage where we've started marketing it.
And so in terms of the consumers, because most of the people wear a retail hat, even if they wear an institutional hat, basically they just go to cityfalcon.com and press the button.
Yeah, so if you go to cityfalcon.com, you can either start building your portfolio, or if you're completely new to investing, we have a wizard to help you. Okay, so I specialize in oil and gas. I understand UK. We tell you these are the stocks trading, so you can create your first watch list.
And in terms of financial news, is a very generic phrase, but in terms of what it specifically means, let's say I'm interested in oil and gas stocks, and I happen to trade them myself, or I've got some in my portfolio or my pension fund or whatever. What do I actually get from City Falcon compared to looking at hashtag, I don't know, oil and gas or something on Twitter?
It's a very good question. So what we do is we are comprehensive. So we cover your traditional news sources, your Financial Times, you know, Wall Street Journal. We look at Twitter, we look at Seeking Alpha, all of these, they are put together. But not only that, we want you to spend less time in front of your computer. So we make it relevant for you.
So basically, is it true to say you're a media aggregator and then a media filter?
Media filter, but we do filtration in a much better way than most other players in the market. I'll give an example. You go on a Saturday, build your portfolio on cityfalcon.com, and you want to see news for what has happened in the last 1 month. So we can tell you the top 10 stories happen in the last 1 month. If you go on any other provider, typically it's a chronological order of news. So on Saturday, you will see news for Friday and Thursday. And so what we do is we rate every financial news, tweet, and author. So for example, your oil and gas, you know, you had, you know, 1 million stories in the last 1 month. We rate everything so we can pick up the 30 stories that you should be looking at.
Right. So in that way, in a sense, and from that perspective, you might call yourself media tech.
Yeah, it could be media tech, fintech. Yes, well, there is an overlap. Yes.
Well, exactly. Is the Financial Times in financial services, or is it in media?
Absolutely.
Or is it in both?
Our focus is, and you know, this has been asked before, we can't give you information about private companies. We can't give you information about other trends in social media. Our focus is financial news, a very financial audience.
And so we've been discussing sort of challenges and all that kind of stuff, and you've been surviving it with lots of hard work and lots of ups and downs and all that kind of stuff. So where is City Falcon going from this point forwards? And if I was a sort of your fairy godmother and I could wave a magic wand, what kind of, you know, big roadblocks remain for you to eliminate?
Sure. So let me just start with saying, back in 2015, there must be about 10 to 15 times I've thought about shutting the business, mainly because of funding, and going back to a full-time job, given the salaries. But we've now come to a stage that we've got traction, we have a product that we are really proud about, and now the next step is, the dream for us is, so we are at 2,000 registrations, we want 100,000 people on our platform. And we want to be able to do that by helping average people invest, by working with partners, and also businesses. One thing that I also want to mention is that we also run a meetup in London called London Value Investing Meetup, where we just help average people getting started onto investing in the markets.
Okay, so that's very clear. And just to sort of wrapping up, as it were, you've written a very good blog post, which I'll link to in the show notes, which is something like, you know, a dozen plus lessons you've learned over the last 2 years. We've spoken about some of them in here, but just in terms of leaving three takeaways with the audience, some of whom may be on a similar journey, some of whom may be contemplating the journey that you've been through, what do you think are the sort of three most things that you wish you could tell yourself 3 years ago?
That's a very good question. I mean, the first thing is, there are no rules in this game, right? If someone comes and tells you, these are the statistics, you can't be a solo founder, you need to find a co-founder, you can't do this, that is all irrelevant. There are experiences, and you learn from those experiences, you adapt to what you need. I mean, we are here to disrupt industries.
Yes, I'd agree with that one. So, you know, to the extent that people gave me advice about podcasting 2 years ago, it was all useless. If I'd followed it, I wouldn't have got to where I am.
Yeah.
Which is a game which I've quoted Lemmy before. I mean, Lemmy said, play your music and your audience will find you, which is a very uncapitalist way of doing it. But the one thing is that you can play your own music much better than you can play somebody else's music. And generally those people who are talking to you actually aren't musicians in the first place.
Absolutely. So yes, listen to people who've run their businesses, who have failed, but treat them as experiences rather than rules. I think that's number one. Number two is, we started off saying there's a lot of funding. What I tell my team today is, assume we get no funding. We have to make this self-sustainable business. Get your customers to fund your business.
So the number two is basically that the life has moved on from the sort of Y2K startups, which is in that tech bubble, everybody wanted to go for scale and things like profits were old hat and that kind of stuff. Actually, that you found and many other fintechs have found that if you're making some positive cash flow, that's quite useful. Good.
And the third thing is, I think as entrepreneurs, we are crazy. We work 24/7. But you can't expect that from your employees. And one of the key mistakes I did was assuming that by throwing money or stock options, employees are ready to work. I think one of the biggest challenges is motivating people, right? How do you motivate people who are passionate about product and design? And that you have to live through, you have to learn. And let me tell you, it's not money that motivates these people.
Excellent. Well, personally, both money and vision also motivate me. So if anybody wants to throw money and vision at me, they're welcome. And thank you for that, Rosabeth. I'll link to your blog articles on the show notes. And I really appreciate, and going back to another Lemmy word, I really appreciate the honesty. And sadly, in the modern world, honesty is far more rare than hype is. And I hope that listeners have got a lot out of it about your experience at the coalface. And as I say, from my experience, your experience at the coalface is relatively generic. You're not the only one. You're not an outlier. This is the core experience of people starting in a fintech in London. So I wish you every success in the next 2 years.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. We are wild like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.